The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Too many lives have been upended because of our failed approach to marijuana. Criminal records for marijuana possession have led to needless barriers to employment, to housing, to educational opportunities.
And with that, the president moved to clear some 6,500 federal convictions for pot possession, plus thousands more in the District of Columbia, though it won't affect the millions more with state-level convictions.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
So much going on this Monday afternoon. John Harper, blessed to be with you as Drew joins a lot of Relevant Radio listeners on our very first pilgrimage to the Holy Land. And we're hopeful that we can connect with Drew live from the Holy Land at some point over the next couple of days. You just heard President Biden talking about what he did in signing that executive order in terms of marijuana. There's so much going on. And don't you feel like we have gone through the looking glass, especially when you see some of these issues of life and just how our culture meets our Catholicism. It just seems like Catholicism is under attack more so than ever. And that's something that we're going to get into and try to come up with some solutions for on this program today. So stand by for that, because we'll involve you in this conversation as well. And also coming up, we have a number of things to talk about, including the 60th anniversary of the start of the Second Vatican Council. And boy, how that has changed the church and continues to change the church in the 21st century. What do we get right? What do we still need to work on? And there's a lot of stuff that's still very fluid from 60 years ago. We'll unpack that coming up. But let me bring you up to date on what's going on here. And of course, you've probably seen some of the video on television or maybe online as well. Those are some of the explosions in Kiev in Ukraine, with the Ukrainian major cities cleaning up from a large barrage of missiles launched by Russia, 11 killed in those attacks. It's nighttime. It's almost midnight now in Ukraine. That voice in the background is Vladimir Putin, and that's him ordering the strikes. He went on television. He ordered those strikes in retaliation for what he believes is the Ukraine bombing that key bridge that connects mainland Russia to Crimea. I'm sure you saw that over the weekend. Kiev took multiple missile attacks. Vitaly Klitschko is the mayor of Kiev, and he doesn't know if more shelling is going to happen.
People is angry and want to defend our houses, defend our families, our children. The message to Putin, we was in the USSR and we don't want back to USSR. Point. We see our future as part of European family.
That's very pointed from Valery Klitschko, who's the mayor of Kiev. Steve Ganyard is a former U.S. diplomat, a senior U.S. diplomat. He's also a Marine Corps colonel, now retired, and he told ABC News, his concern now is what Russia is going to do on the power grid and the infrastructure of the country going into the winter.
The thing that concerns me the most here is the attacks on infrastructure. Sometimes when you hit parts of the power infrastructure, it can take a long time to repair. And he's doing this just prior to winter, trying to take away electricity, which is obviously important for the economy, for heating homes, and for the well-being of the Ukrainian people.
And of course, we'll watch that, and it has an impact, obviously, on us as well, as we've seen prices spike in all fuels since the Ukraine-Russian war has started. And now OPEC, of course, is cutting the oil production on a daily basis by some 2 million barrels. And that's one of the things that we'll get to a little bit later on when Dr. Paul Kangor joins us. Let's talk about issues of life. Lots to talk about on the pro-life front this afternoon. We've got judges striking down restrictive abortion laws in both Arizona and Ohio. In Ohio, it was a 6-week abortion ban that's been indefinitely blocked right now. And that was a ban that was challenged by the ACLU. Hamilton County, by Cincinnati, Judge Christian Jenkins issued a 14-day restraining order, meaning that abortions can happen up to 22 weeks. So that's what's happening in Ohio right now. The Ohio law had prohibited abortion after a fetal heartbeat is detected. The attorney general of the state of Ohio is appealing that ruling. In Arizona, a court issued a stay on Friday on a near total abortion ban, with criminal penalties temporarily blocking enforcement of the ban. And that was an appeal filed by, you're right, Planned Parenthood. Now, Arizona, it's interesting. Arizona's got a nearly century-old abortion ban. It actually goes back to the early 1800s that made abortions punishable by 2 to 5 years in prison. And the judge's ruling said that the old law needs more clarity. Friday's decision now allows abortion care to resume, at least temporarily, in the state of Arizona. Power's back on for a good portion of Lee County, Charlotte County, around Fort Myers, Florida. Sheriff Carmine Mercino.
I can't praise Florida Power and Lighting enough. As of today, they're reporting 99% of their customers have power.
And Sheriff Mercino says his team is still working to determine if everybody's accounted for.
As of this morning, we've done 1,125 total rescues. 1,125 rescues. The death toll for the county at this point is 56. 56. And we're still investigating 685 well-being checks.
Governor Ron DeSantis was in Southwest Florida today. He was in Port Charlotte. He explained how the state helped coordinate power restoration and the debris removal from county schools. Some of those schools open today.
There's still a couple pockets of Lee County with the Lee County Electrical Cooperative, but all the other providers are at basically 100%.
I got to double check with our engineers to see if we're back on the air in Fort Myers, because the transmitter that we have in Fort Myers was under 3 feet of water. So it survived the winds. They just put up a new fence around the building. That got blown down. But the building itself survived the winds, but then all of the rain. There's 3 feet of water and a very expensive transmitter. So we may still be off the air. I'll get an update on that from, I'll text one of the engineers and just let you know. If you're listening in Southwest Florida on Relevant Radio, welcome. Just give us a call, 888-914-9149. Let's talk about these issues of life. And you've heard us talk about the lawsuits that are being filed challenging state abortion bans. And the grounds of those lawsuits is that they violate religious beliefs. Now, in Florida, three women sued on the grounds that the state abortion ban violates religious beliefs of Jews and members of other faiths who did not believe our Christian Catholic belief that human life begins at conception. There's a similar suit that's been filed now in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. Let's take apart some of these complaints and how to move forward as we stand for life. Eric Niffen joins us again. He practices law at Lewis Rocha in Colorado Springs, Colorado, where he has worked on the HHS mandate. And before that, he was at Beckett Law, where he worked on the mandate and other cases of religious liberty. Eric, welcome back to the Drew Mariani Show.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
It's good to be with you. And we're going to see so many of these suits being filed. When you look at the arguments in this particular case in Florida, the three women who say that the fact that Christians and Catholics believe that human life begins at conception and it violates the religious beliefs of anyone who's not Christian and Catholic, what standing does that argument have in a court before a judge, or does it depend on the judge who hears the case?
Well, So that argument sounds like an Establishment Clause challenge, saying that this is sort of a theocratic law that says that unborn life should be protected. And there's a couple different ways to come at that. First of all, is to look to the Supreme Court's decision in Dobbs and say there's no theological premises in there. So I don't think it's accurate description of what the Supreme Court did. But I suppose if you wanted to back all the way up and says, well, look, it says do not kill in the Ten Commandments. Does that mean that we should also get rid of laws against murder because they are also premised on some sort of religious understanding? There are moral claims throughout the law, even something like you shouldn't speed. You shouldn't go over 30 miles on an unnoticed road. There are moral claims implicit in every law. And so I'm just not quite sure. I don't think that's going to go anywhere because It would really unravel all of our law to say that, you know, a moral claim that comes somehow from a religious tradition can't be the basis of a law. There's just no way to enforce that.
Would you argue in a court of law about the Ten Commandments? Would you bring the Ten Commandments up in this argument in a court of law?
I think I would if I had to answer this challenge. It sort of says that, yeah, you know, a law restricting abortion is fundamentally religious. And I'd say, well, in some general sense, but, you know, laws, you know, we don't have another society besides our own in Western world. We're part of the Western world. That Western world is built on the church and, you know, Christian traditions and Jewish traditions behind that. We just don't have a theoretical United States that doesn't have that as a background. And we also have laws against murder. We have laws against theft, which are prohibited in the Ten Commandments. So I think it's a fair way to sort of say, look, if you're going to say this can't be a law because it's prohibited by some people for religious reasons, or there's some religious traditions that prohibit it, then we're going to undo a whole heck more laws than that. And that can't be just the right to say that because it's covered by a religious tradition or prohibited within some religious tradition, therefore it can't be a law. There's just no way that's right.
Eric, as I look at this Florida case and these three women who are suing, they are going into the, and we've heard the arguments before, well, where does it say this in the Bible? And they're arguing that the Jewish views on the beginning of life, certainly originated in the Torah, but there's nothing in the Torah that talks about what we believe as Catholic Christians, that life begins at the moment of conception. So, again, you can see where this gray area is going. Are we going to just be faced with these cases, do you believe, for the indefinite future as the argument over life comes back to the states? Is this something that we're just going to have to live with constantly?
We're going to have to live with this for some time, but these are relatively easy cases, and these issues are going to be resolved in the court, and then we'll be done with it. That's what I think is going to happen. So for now, but not for too long.
Let's talk a little bit about this Kentucky case as well, because the complaint argues, and this talks about abortion after genetic counseling or the destruction of in vitro fertilization embryos under the Kentucky law, that would be capital murder.
Sure. So tell me a little bit more about, are these people saying that they have a religious interest in performing such abortions or having such abortions?
Well, they just, they all of these people who are challenging the people in Florida and again in Kentucky just, want... I think what they're both looking for, my interpretation, I'm not an attorney, is to take laws that in some cases seem vague and make them even more vague. So there's a wider berth for litigation moving forward. So any real abortion ban that we've been praying for and we continue to pray for that's going to come back into our states gets roadblocked and constantly roadblocked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, I think there's the religious liberty challenges is one part of it. But I think, it is an open question in terms of whether the Constitution protects any right to an abortion at any stage. Mm-hmm. Is there some point at which the state's interest in preserving, a 3-week old fetus is not strong enough interest to override the women's autonomy interest? That is not a question that the Supreme Court answered. And so that is something that is going to be the basis of a lot of litigation for a while in terms of how we balance a woman's interest, because the Supreme Court didn't say a woman has no interest. So what is the woman's interest in not being pregnant versus the state's interest in protecting human life, including unborn human life? That is an open question. And so I think that's the main, area where these abortion laws are going to be challenged. That to me is a much more fruitful way to attack laws that restrict the earliest abortions under our law right now than a religious liberty challenge. I don't think those religious liberty challenges are going anywhere.
Our conversation on more lawsuits against what we stand for is life in this particular case, in actually two cases, one in Kentucky and one in Florida, taking a look at staunch abortion laws as a violation of religious beliefs. Our conversation here on the Drew Mariani Show with Eric Niffen, who practices law at Lewis Rocha in Colorado Springs, and he's worked on the HHS mandate and other issues of life. And of course, you can join our conversation here on Relevant Radio at 888-914-9149. Our number here on the Drew Mariani Show is 888-914-9149. As Kentucky, and to an extent the argument in Florida, Eric, talks about bringing more vagaries into that, what is the mandate for those who are defining and writing laws that will happen within our states to be as specific as possible? And can you possibly have, how much specificity can you actually put in these laws so they are as airtight as possible, when they get passed?
Yeah, I don't know exactly the right balance right there. You know, it's really hard. Laws have to be general because they have to apply to situations that haven't come up yet. So laws always have some level of generality. Generally, laws can get struck down for being too vague if they don't give people enough information to guide their own actions. So, you know, a law that says you cannot be too violent with somebody. And they're like, well, who knows what that means? And how do I engage with someone if I know that some judge might say that I was being too violent and I could go to jail for that? And so for doctors want to know, nurses, you know, other sorts of people, you know, what am I supposed to do here? How do I balance these rights and what am I allowed to do? And having a law that is just too vague doesn't give people guidance. And so I think that's one sort of way to sort of press against these laws. But again, I think the main argument is going to be over whether, you know, is there anything that's remaining in this constitutional right to an abortion after Dobbs? And the Supreme Court, again, didn't quite answer that. It says we don't have to answer that. We just have to solve this case right before us. And so I think there's going to be questions with the most strict abortion laws and saying that runs up against the constitutional problem. But we're just going to have to see exactly how that shakes out.
I know we're playing with words here, Eric, and I'm asking you to be a wordsmith here, but what's the difference between generalities and vagaries in writing a law?
Yeah, it's really the difference in the lawyer that's writing a brief on one side versus the other. Okay. There's not a really good definition there. Again, laws have to have a certain level of generality. They can't speak to, you know, a law against murder cannot specifically describe every different situation in which a murder might take place.
Right.
It's just going to have a general rule. And then that has to be applied by judges to individual circumstances. And so that's going to be the case here. So, you know, people can say it's too vague, but I think the other answer coming back the other way is like, look, this is just what laws do, is laws set up broad principles and it's clear enough and that's it. And those are going to be the arguments in these things.
I asked that question, Eric, because the language in a lot of these state laws, as I look at what's on the books now in Kentucky and certainly in Arizona that goes back to the mid-19th century, they're so vague that it's really difficult to interpret. And I don't know how a judge would do it because, you know, there are non-medical terms that put doctors and patients in some untenable positions. I mean, for example, should physicians render care to a pregnant woman? She's in a dangerous pregnancy. Let's take the Arizona case. But is she and the doctor, are they risking prosecution because of this opaque language? I think that's the right word in this context of this 19th century law. You know, this is the uncertainty in these laws that make these days post Roe v. Wade so confusing for us. And I can imagine what it's doing in the judicial system.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's a really fair point, and I would be very sympathetic to doctors and nurses that say we want more clarity. We want a better, newer law that addresses modern technology, that uses better terminology, that gives us more guidance in terms of what the law expects us to do. Vague laws are just harmful because they create uncertainty. And so I think, you know, this is an area in which it's legitimate for healthcare institutions to want more clarity.
What
and
kind
these
of
laws haven't been operable. They haven't been operable. No one's really looked at these for 50 years. And so all of a sudden we dust them off and we say, so what exactly does this mean? And we don't have court cases interpreting them for 50 years. And
right.
So we're kind of coming at this fresh, and it's going to take some time. As always happens, Locke sort of comes into a new area and says, well, it's going to take a while for things to shake out. And so that's not a bad thing. It's just the natural way that law works.
I'm going to put you on the spot here. If you were writing a law that, you know, certainly meets, as you say, the general characteristics of most laws so they can be argued in court, what would be some of the bullet points you would put in a law if you were to advise a state to put together a comprehensive law that bans abortion? What are some of the bullet points that you would put in there to, again, I know it's not going to be airtight, but to give it that specificity that we need moving forward. So we don't have a situation like we have in Kentucky or the confusion that's happening in Arizona right now.
I think one of the most important thing to do is to recite why the state believes it has an interest in doing this. And that's something the Supreme Court covered at the end of its opinion in Dobbs, is talking about, like, what are the legitimate reasons why a state would want to restrict this? And sort of the Supreme Court says, well, you could have respect for and preservation of prenatal life at all stages of development. The Supreme Court said that's a totally legitimate thing. The protection of maternal health and safety, the elimination of particularly gruesome or barbaric medical procedures, the preservation of the integrity of the medical profession, the mitigation of fetal pain. All those things the Supreme Court said are legitimate reasons why a state would want to restrict abortion. So that's the number one thing is to check off. And then I think you have to make a judgment call in terms of how early the ban is going to go. Is it going to go all the way back to conception, or is it going to go at some point, you know, 10 weeks, 12 weeks, 15 weeks? I think there are legitimate prudential judgments there in terms of how to pass a law that's going to have the most support from people. It's still going to be important incremental change in defense of life. What is the sort of law that we think is most likely to get upheld in a court? Or you might just say, you know what, I realize it's a little bit riskier, but I want to take a strong position. And I want to say that I believe all unborn human life ought to be protected in law. Those are all legitimate goals of legislation. And so I don't think there's any one way to do this. It's kind of like when I sit down with my clients, they say, hey, what should we have in our policy? And I say, we can't talk about that, kid, because you have to tell me about what your interests are.
Right.
And so talking about those interests and how you rank them is really important in sort of saying, well, what sort of law do you want to pass? And those involve a lot of important political and prudential judgments.
Eric, in the couple of moments we have remaining, you mentioned legislation in this Kentucky lawsuit. Now state legislators have to wrestle with all of these terms of what the law says, what it could say. As a member of the legal community and those members of the legal community hearing our conversation on Relevant Radio who stand for life, what is the advice that you would give, or how proactive should you get if you're a pro-life attorney with your state legislators to make sure that the language in these laws is correct?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit different in situations where laws have already been challenged to sort of say, well, does the state want to come up with a backup law, sort of replace that law with some new language now, or do they want to wait until the lawsuit shakes out? I don't know the best situation in that instance. I do think that one of the really great things that's happened in the last 10, 15 years is national groups helping provide model legislation for things like this. So that's maybe the number one piece of advice I'd give to a state legislator is you're not doing this alone. And there's a lot of other people who are thinking about this and trying to think about how do we pass a law that does the most good and stands the most chance of surviving lawsuits. And so making sure that legislators are talking to colleagues across the country about these issues is, I think, the number one step before you commit to a certain proposal.
Eric, we are so blessed to have your clarity here on Relevant Radio. I know we put you in a situation where you have to instantly argue a case. In this particular instance, it's on the radio, but we really do appreciate your wisdom. And of course, that wisdom comes from practicing law for a number of years with Lewis Rocha in Colorado Springs and also at Beckett Law, where he worked on the HHS mandate and other cases of religious liberty. And this will not be the first time or the last time that we talk about these issues as more of these cases crop up now in Ohio, in Florida, and also in Arizona. Eric, thanks and God bless.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
Advent coming up really fast. I know it's already the middle of October. Isn't this something? Where's the time going? And so Advent's starting in 6 weeks, and you can really celebrate the Christmas season in a very beautiful way with a nativity set. We're giving away 200 here at Relevant Radio. These are gorgeous. I have one. They're made possible by a very generous donor. They're hand-painted. They're perfect for your porch. You can put it in your window, your front yard, and it's absolutely wonderful. But in order to win, you have to sign up. You got to enter before October 16th. That's at the end of the week. All you have to do is go to relevantradio.com/set. Relevantradio.com/set. Win one of the 200 nativity sets we're giving away here at Relevant Radio. John Harper in for Drew this afternoon on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Insight and analysis right here. It's the Drew Mariani Show. Relevant Radio.
This hour sponsored by Creative Planning. How are you aligning your financial plan with your Catholic values? Is your Catholic faith influencing your financial future? More info, including disclosures, at creativeplanning.com/Catholic Focus.
Your Life Connected, The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
John Harper in for Drew, who's on pilgrimage in the Holy Land with a group of Relevant Radio listeners. You know, it's appropriate that we're playing You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet, because when you see what happens coming out of especially blue states, and I don't mean to be political, but in this particular case, it fits in the state of New York. They just embrace abortion. And now it's also polygamy. And you know what polygamy is? That's marrying multiple spouses. Now, if you think, well, you know, who would? There's no sensible human being who would understand that. Listen to this. And this is 2022. This is right now. 23% of Americans think polygamy is, quote, morally acceptable. Let that sink in for a moment of how far we have gone down the slippery slope and how Satan is at work here. And now there's a New York judge who agrees with that 22%. Let's take a look at this right now. I can see you. I'm shaking my head. I can see you doing that as well at the other end of the speaker. Professor Teresa Stanton Collette teaches at the University of St. Thomas School of Law. She served on the Pontifical Council for the Family and has testified before Congress. Teresa, welcome back. Are you shaking your head as well?
I'm so far past shaking my head with what these people are doing. It is just the destruction of civilization as we watch, unfortunately.
Well, what is the deal with some of these judges? We were having, you know, the conversation about all of these lawsuits, many of which seem frivolous, challenging abortion laws that have been on the books for a while, or more comprehensive abortion laws that are now on the books, thanks be to God. And these are frivolous lawsuits. But again, here's a judge who agrees with 22% saying, yeah, marry as many people as you want.
Well, of course, you know, Justice Scalia warned about this when the Obergefell opinion came down from the U.S. Supreme Court that redefined marriage for the entire country, mm-hmm. even though a majority of states at the time had either state constitutional amendments or statutes that clearly defined marriage as a union of one man and one woman. There were over 30 states, many of whom had recently readopted that position, and the court said the people's decision in this area doesn't matter. So it was foreseeable, but it has taken less time to get there than many of us thought it would take.
Exactly. But, you know, you and I have seen a lot of things happen in the last several years. Being the old one on the show, I remember when Vatican II started in 1962. Admittedly, I was in elementary school, but old enough to understand what was going on there. And the 60th anniversary is tomorrow. But as I look over the last 60, let's just look at the last 5 years, Teresa. The last 5 years. I don't have to go back 60. Just 5 years. We're seeing laws of tolerance now, aren't we? These are laws of tolerance. How do we put that genie back in the bottle? Because it does affect us as Catholics moving forward here in the United States, where if these laws of tolerance are happening, here comes more religious persecution. I hate to be this doomsday person, but it just adds up, doesn't it?
That is exactly what's happening. The baker in Colorado that many of your listeners know of is being yet again prosecuted by the state for his refusal in this case to not bake a cake to celebrate a transition from male to female or male female to male. So it's not sufficient now to say live and let live, but we have to openly approve, have our children taught, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Am I being overly dramatic here? And you can stop me if, when we see what's happening with this New York judge siding with some 22% of the American people who believe polygamy, marriage to more than one person, is acceptable. This is in the state of New York. That we're not only looking at the breakdown of traditional marriage, but this really then becomes an attack on children and the future generations of this country.
Well, and that's the problem. Marriage as a civil institution, not as a sacrament, not as a religious institution, the function of marriage was to ensure that children who were conceived by the heterosexual act of making love would have the benefit of both their mother and their father living in the same household. It wasn't about adult happiness. It wasn't created. You know, the government does not, nor should it, license friendship. It doesn't license love per se. What it licenses is a union that gives rise to the creation of children who need to be raised by a mother and a father.
You know, what's interesting is for those of us on the radio and television who have been talking about this, do you remember 20 years ago when we were laughed at, when we talked about, you know, issues in terms of sexualizing the military and all of those issues 20 years ago? Well, here we are two decades later. And now if you're a parent here in the United States, especially if you're a Catholic parent, you're in the fight of your life. Transgenderism, judges paving the way for plural marriages, and everything else that's going on.
Well, and in 2016, as late as 2016, the New York Times ran an op-ed that said, you know, polygamy is harmful to women. Polygamy allows the vulnerable in the relationship to be taken advantage of, including both the vulnerable partner and the children itself. And now we are seeing increasing numbers of people that would affirm it. You know, when the Obergefell opinion came down, only 7% of Americans thought that polygamy was acceptable.
And even that number is astounding, isn't it? Professor Teresa Collette is joining us today, and she teaches at the University of St. Thomas Law School. We're talking about polygamy, being able to be married to more than one person. 22% of Americans now in a survey that just came out think that that's okay, and so does a judge in the state of New York as well, as we take a look at some of the very liberal, and I'm being polite here, laws that seem to be making it to the light of day in the state of New York. Love to have you join the conversation here, and let's try to come up with some solutions, or at least the narrative of what you and I have to do and stand up as Roman Catholic men and women to start pushing back and communicating what marriage truly is. Number one, a sacrament. And number two, it's between a man and a woman and God as well. 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149 is our number here on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. The American Psychological Association is on the side of the judges and these 22% of Americans who were surveyed, Professor.
Well, but let's be fair. This is one singular judge. It may or may not prove to be upheld. It may or may not be something that the rest of the judiciary is willing to impose its will on the people. Remember that we won a lot of the early marriage fights when the courts were trying to redefine marriage. Now, again, because it went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, we ultimately lost that fight. But at the intermediate court level and at the state Supreme Court levels, we won several of those fights as well, and we certainly won them legislatively.
But I also fear that there are no boundaries here. Yes, you do have a point, but the snowball is going down the hill because, you know, we see almost on a daily basis with these headlines that we bring to the table here on Relevant Radio, a nation that is a secular nation that is rejecting God's design.
We are seeing, I think, the desperate need for evangelization in the culture. And that's not just evident in this area. It's evident in the soaring suicide rates. It's evident in the soaring anxiety rates. We have to have that springtime of evangelization that St. John Paul II called for us to have. And it needs to be the task of every faithful Catholic to show the presence of Christ through their actions every single day. Because without that, pagan culture will prevail. I think you're right on that. But with eight grandchildren, I am unwilling to say that that's going to be the conclusion of this country in my lifetime. We know the ultimate end of the story from scripture.
Sure.
But, I'm not willing to give up the fight for right now.
Me neither. I'm right there. I got your back, and I'm hopeful you have mine. And we have the backs of our Relevant Radio listeners, and you guys know that at 888-914-9149 with Professor Teresa Stanton Collette at the University of St. Thomas School of Law. As we talk about 22% of Americans in a brand new poll that's just out, believe, hey, polygamy is okay. And yeah, as Professor Teresa points out, it's one judge in the state of New York that says, yeah, I'll support polygamy here in the state of New York, but that's all it takes. May I ask you a question, a personal question? How old are your grandchildren? What are the age ranges?
They range from age 4 to age 18. In fact, we just took the 18-year-old who had a very successful high school career and is headed off to college. We took her to Spain as a graduation 18th birthday gift to celebrate how hard she had worked.
Oh, that's wonderful. So how have you had these conversations with your grandchildren who are old enough to understand, and especially your granddaughter now going on to college? Because that's a seismic shift in the life cycle of any person, no matter how strong your faith is.
Well, my husband and I have both been married to each other. We've both been married to each other. Imagine that for 44 years. And so part of it is the lived reality and talking about what really makes for a stable family, what makes for the sort of success that both in the secular world, but the emotional success of happy, healthy children. And that leads us to talk about sexual morality itself. And we talk about that, you know, you can't give your body without giving your heart at some level.
Right.
And when you give your heart without adequate time to really get to know the person, it's going to get broken. And so you really need to guard your heart. You need to guard, and one way to guard your heart is to guard your body. You're worth more than any particular invitation at any particular point in time. Hold out for that person that believes that they would give up their life for you, as Ephesians says.
Right.
That's the man that you want to partner with throughout life, because life happens and there will be some glorious, amazing, wonderful moments, but there's not a family that exists that hasn't had some tragedy come their way in some form.
Sure. Sure.
And that's the partner you want.
Right, exactly. And, you know, in the context of family, as you so beautifully describe it, Professor, but also in the context of relativism that we have seen just running rampant here in the United States for a number of years, what then is the definition of tolerance that we should be teaching our kids?
I think I don't see the word tolerance anywhere in Scripture. I think we are to teach our children how to discern truth and how to graciously offer truth and, if necessary, defend truth. Tolerance may be that all of us have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. All of us have made bad decisions. All of us have failed to discern certain truths at times because our own appetites get in our way. and so I think I talk more about there, but the grace of God go I, not this is acceptable and you have to, because tolerance at one level almost is equivalent to indifference. And the indifference of society is, I think, part of why we're seeing the soaring anxiety rates, the feeling of isolation and loneliness. I don't want my neighbors to be indifferent to me. I want them to care about me, just and to let me care about them. But I also have to accept that we're all fallen creatures, and it may truly be the log in my eye rather than the speck in yours. So there has to be a humility about this as well.
We got to get you in front of that judge in New York, Professor, because that is just so beautiful and really the mission that we should be living as Roman Catholic men and women. Professor Teresa Stanton-Collett from the University of St. Thomas School of Law. We're talking about polygamy. Yes, being married to more than one person. Now 22% of Americans say, hey, it's okay. And yeah, there's a judge in New York that says, hey, it's okay as well. 888-914-9149 as we talk about discernment, the common good, and whatever tolerance is in the context of this conversation, and that's one that is being, that word tolerance is being abused, certainly by this judge, my opinion, and also what we see in the statistics from this recent research project that show that 22% of Americans believe polygamy is okay. What about you? 888-914-9149. How do we fight this? What do we do? What's our message as Catholics? You can help write that script right now. 888-914-9149 as we continue here on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
The Drew Mariani Show. Connected. Relevant Radio.
Relevant Radio runs on horsepower. Your horsepower. Donate any vehicle and keep your station running. Join in with thousands of other listeners who have given their unused vehicles at relevantradio.com/car.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
John Harper in for Drew this afternoon, and like you, we're scratching our heads here when you hear stories that 22% of Americans in this year, 2022, believe polygamy, being married to more than one person, is okay. There's a judge in New York who's siding with those 22% right now, and we're taking that apart and also trying to find some solutions and what our conversation should be as Catholics, especially as we talk about issues of the common good, matrimony as a sacrament, God's basic design, what basic biology is, simply all of those real truths, underscore that word truths and put it in bold. And that's what we're trying to do here with your help at 888-914-9149. Our conversation with Professor Teresa Stanton-Collett, who teaches at the University of St. Thomas School of Law. Alvin's joining our conversation. Excuse me. Mark is joining our conversation in Alvin, Texas, just outside of Houston. Mark, welcome to Relevant Radio. You're on with Professor Collett.
Hey, thanks a lot. I appreciate it. I'm not a professor, but I am a businessman. I've been a businessman for 50 years, and I think the problem started a long time ago with no-fault divorce. I think about a contract as an agreement, and I think I'm a Christian too. I'm a Catholic Christian, so I believe that a marriage is even more than a contract. But to be able to walk away from something without some kind of really big deal being made of it is a it's the beginning of the end. And I think no-fault divorce was the beginning of all this stuff.
Mark, I couldn't agree with you more. And in fact, can you hear me, Mark?
Yes, yeah, I can hear you now. Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. I was about to say, I can't agree with you more. In fact, when I teach property law, we talk about the fact that there is no other contract that you can walk away with, no money damages, but no fault divorce, and how damaging that has been to the stability of the family itself. And again, Bob and I have been married for 44 years, and it has not been all, you know, moonlight and roses every single day.
Sure.
But
Teresa's phone just cut out. Mark, how long have you been married?
I've been married 35 years, and I always like to tell folks, too, my parents were married for 65 years, and they could have been divorced 100 times, but they didn't. and thank God for it, too.
Yeah, no, I understand. My mom and dad, before my dad passed away, were married for 43 years. And yeah, they had plenty of disagreements. But one of the things, and you've probably heard me tell this story on Relevant Radio, the one takeaway that I have as a kid, as an only child from my mom and dad and the times that they disagreed with each other, one would wind up laughing, and every argument would wind up in laughter and a hug. It was almost as if it was a situation comedy on television, and in 22 minutes it got solved and everybody's hugging. But that's what always happened. There was laughter in our house, and it even came out of the, wait a minute, we love each other so much, what are we doing here? And then when they would look at each other, and I just remember this as a kid, no one could remember what they were angry about, Mark, you know? And yeah, so, you know, that's
know
the
exactly
that's,
what you're saying.
That's the lasting mark that I'm sure you put on your children. Thanks so much for joining our conversation. Thanks for listening in Houston, Texas to Relevant Radio 1110. Marlo's in the San Fernando Valley of California. We're on with Professor Teresa Collette, and we're talking about the fact that 22% of Americans believe polygamy, being married to one person, is okay. And now there's a judge in New York that's siding with those 22%. Marla, good afternoon. Welcome to Relevant Radio. Hi, Marla. It's your turn. You there? Okay, let's put Mark.
Hey,
there you go.
Sorry.
Oh, it's Maria. I'm sorry. I'm calling you by the wrong name. I didn't see the dot above the I. I made the I and L. Oh, I apologize.
That's fine. Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. My question is the 22% that want polygamy marriage, these people, what group do they fall in? Are they...
We're having trouble with your phone there. And what she's asking, Professor, is of that 22%, are they heterosexual, homosexual? You know, what kind of relationship are they're in? And the parameters of the research project didn't include that. It's just 22% of adults. But you wonder also how we got to 22%, you know?
Well, and we know from political polling, it's not always accurate of people's actual views.
But still, it's a pretty big number.
It is a big number, and it's three times what it was right after Obergefell. So that's concerning. Part of it is also in the advertisements, that commercials during the break mentions that the influence of culture, right? That we're seeing all of the different movies that make this look fun and more entertaining and this is desirable, when in fact they don't show the tragedy that can result from it.
Right.
And so that is one of the reasons that so many families are beginning to look more and more seriously at Catholic schools, because they want their children raised in an environment where the books they're reading, the images they're seeing, they want their children to be in a wholesome environment. And so, you know, we have to protect not just our children, but ourselves from the lures of culture that makes so many things look desirable that simply will end in tragedy and sadness.
In the context of this conversation, how do we then communicate the common good and not be laughed at?
Well, I think, you know, having been a part of the marriage debate in the political arena for a number of years, I'm the only laugh that I'm concerned about, and I actually desire it, is laughter of heaven when I do something, you know.
Right.
Justice Scalia got into trouble for quoting at a breakfast that he's happy to be a fool for Christ. And so I think that's an important thing to communicate.
In 2022, and you're right, it is important to communicate that we all want to be fools for Christ. And that's a role that I want to occupy as well with you, Professor Teresa. But at the same time, again, this is where culture pushes up against our Catholicism. We want to be liked. I mean, that's a natural human reaction. We want to be liked. We want to be accepted. And being a fool for Christ and being accepted in this culture, not necessarily the same thing.
For others who have been consistent and have been faithful.
Okay, can you say that? We're having trouble with your phone, Professor.
I'm sorry.
And we missed that last answer.
I was just saying that ultimately, though, the people that other people come to value and trust are the people who are just time, who are truthful, and the hands and feet of Christ. And if that gets us laughed at because we're fools and wasting our money on the poor, or because we're teaching chastity as a way to happiness, then I think we just have to tolerate that and know that there is a better time ahead. Nothing lasts forever except our union with God.
What do you say when someone, and we've heard this argument from the 22%, and I'm not sure if the judge has mentioned this, but when you argue about this and just say, well, wait a minute, polygamy, isn't that the next gay marriage? They look at you and they just say, well, you know, come on, live and let live. They say, no, that's never going to happen. And the last thing you want to do is, you know, one of those situation comedy, I told you so's, but I told you so with same-sex marriage. I mean, Justice Scalia was talking about this years before. We were talking about this years before the Supreme Court decision came down in 2015. So when you hear those on the left say, oh, come on, you're being dramatic, polygamy can't be the next gay marriage, what do you say?
Actually, the world I live in as a professor, as a university professor, that's not the answer I'm getting anymore. The answer I get is, and what's wrong with that?
Oh, my.
That's the answer I'm getting.
Wow.
And so my answer to that is, what's wrong with it is each of us want to be unique and special and be in a relationship with the one person who loves us as much as we love them. And that while there are different types of love that can be shared among many people, marital love is unique. I want to be the most important person in the world to my husband, and he wants to be the most important person in the world to me.
And we're going to leave it with that eloquence, Professor. Thank you so much for your perspective on this. That's a beautiful treatise in 20 seconds about the sanctity of marriage. Professor Teresa Stanton-Collette from the University of St. Thomas School of Law, here on the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.